Well, in the midst of what seems like an extremely chaotic time, extremely bewildering and dramatic and kind of overwhelming time, it's wonderful to be able to sit here and let the sunlight come streaming into the room and the leaves begin to gently fall off the trees and watch the shadows change as the light changes, and why, you would never know that anything was going on at all. Is anything going on? It's a very interesting question. What does this all mean? What does it mean for us? Is it real? Is it more real than it was this time last year? I love that we chant the Metta Sutra for these day-long sits. I think it creates a wonderful contrast to what our minds tend to do, which is to see through a kind of telescope and see things as not very good. Something wrong. Something's going wrong always. And the Metta Sutra doesn't say everything is okay. It doesn't say everything is fine. What it does is give it back to us. It's up to us how we see it, how we choose. And it also points out our tendency, which is sometimes to be mean, sometimes to be greedy, to want too many things. And then we remember, oh, well, yes, and no, that we have a choice. And in all these dramas that we go through as a culture, as a people, we are the people in many ways, of course. That's how it works. But on the other hand, we're each one of us holding our own seat, living our own wisdom. And the longer we practice, and the deeper and more powerfully we practice, the more we're able to maintain our own integrity and sense of meaning, and to examine carefully each idea that comes to us. Is this true? What they say? What they say? And as you know, they are always saying something. There's always some kind of new idea, some new explanation for everything. It takes that backward step that Dogen talks about, to be able to step back and really look at it. And often we can't even say. We have to say, I don't know. I don't really know enough to know. And not knowing is really fine. Hakuin Zenji said, fingers clasp, feet walk on, without help from others, as thoughts and emotions pile up great stocks of wrong. It's kind of what we do without thinking. We're always sort of reverting to the wrong. accumulating all the faults of others, our own faults. Our mind is often very busy about how things ought to be. He said, but cast out pro and con, all your likes and dislikes, and I'll confirm you as Kanji Zai, right where you stand. Kanji Zai, meaning Avalokiteshvara. Like compassion happens when we cast out pro and con. That seems outrageous. It seems like, especially in trying times, that we have to choose, take a side, know what's right and what's wrong. But for compassion to work, both sides are included. You could say cast out pro and con, but you could also say incorporate pro and con. Examine them carefully. Take them in. Know them well. Especially in times like this, it seems like so much of what we know and experience comes to us through what's called media, which means that it's flat and it's cartoon-like. We don't know who all those people are. And if we look at each other and how fully embodied we are, and our friends and our relatives, and how we know each other as warm flesh beings and lively, full of life beings, and then we see what's in the newspaper and what's on television, and there are these flickering, flat, cartoon-like, talking beings that aren't really real. It's just it's very remote from our actual warm life flesh experience of things. It changes how we know what we know. And unless we're really careful, we begin to think we know more than we do. So I think Hakuin's suggestion of throwing out the pros and pro and con gives us some space to at least accept that how little we know. And then to really look, not out there, but in here. What's needed? What's needed now? What's needed here? What can I do? It's easy to feel helpless. We're supposed to feel helpless in a way. We're encouraged to feel helpless. So our practice is really, really important because it brings us back to who we are and where we are and gives us the freedom to be our breath and to know our own mind. And to trust it. Taking our bodhisattva seat, Hakuin says, acting according to circumstances in response to sentient beings, wherever they may be, the bodhisattva still never leaves the bodhisattva seat. He says, unless you're clean, you'll have a lot to think about as you confront the world. Unless you're clean, What do you think? Jane?
What we've got.
Yeah.
And it just feels intimate when you say that. You're not turning away from yourself and bringing maybe close before to make it steady. And it feels like a really reliable path. To where it is. You know, to that place we're trying to go to.
That place where we already are. Yes. Well, it's what Dogen said, we study the self. And in studying the self, of course, everything is included. All the hard, difficult, miserable, confused, wrong places, as well as, you know, it's studying all of it. But it's to study in order to drop the subject. You know, if we're completely obsessed with the self of ourself, we miss everybody else, everything else. So it works both ways, and it's not like a one-time thing. It just keeps processing as a function of how life works itself. We study the self and become familiar with our situation and begin to feel free in it. And inevitably, everything changes and we have to start over again. And we've all done that a million times, and we will do it a million times. It's just the way life works. So we study the self of the moment, the self of this situation, and hold our seat in it with as much integrity as we can, and are willing to let the whole thing go into whatever the next new thing is going to be. That's where it gets scary, because we don't know what the next new thing is going to be. And once we get familiar with where we are, even if it's not a very good situation, we'd much rather stay in it than go into the unknown. The unknown is a very unpleasant place for the human mind. Even though it doesn't exist, really. It's just all made up. You know? But we project this sort of monstrous darkness out there that's going to eat us up. And then when it happens, whatever the next thing is, it's never like that. We're very curious creatures. Just very, very peculiar the way the mind works. And the more it's studied, the more peculiar it seems. We've got so much background, and we haven't quite integrated it all. I don't know what another 10,000 years would bring for the human race. We've only been doing this for such a short time. we really don't know how to do it very well. We only started living in villages 10,000 years ago. That's nothing. And we're doing this clumsy, crazy dance, trying to make sense of everything. And all along we've had meditation practice. And all along I think meditation practice in some form has kept us in some kind of balance and kept us aware of some kind of wisdom that keeps us sane. Julian?
In what you read, it talked about being clean. Think about like the duality, like, because there's, when you talk about clean, always not clean, and grappling with that. And in the Heart Sutra, it talks about like no attainment.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of hard to keep it all. Without sounding totally wishy-washy, it's just curious to me about that. But I guess it kind of makes sense in a way. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, it doesn't make sense in the logical way. It's a tremendous relief that no attainment. Because in spite of ourselves, we always get tangled up in our wish to attain something. In practice, especially, even though we say we come and we're just sitting, there's still this sort of sense of there's some place to go and something to get, something better to get. And when we come to that part of it, nothing to attain. The bodhisattva depends on prajnaparamita. Depends on inherent wisdom, that there's no place to go and nothing to get. It's such a relief. Whew. Me too.
And you talked today in some other teaching. I guess I'm seeing this. I don't know if it's a dichotomy, but holding these two things. One is like really, like the mental switch, like really loving, focusing on everything. At the same time,
yeah.
Like you say, being ready to kiss it goodbye. And so I think I know the answer. But could you talk a little bit, how do we hold those things? Just being so, you know, working hard, I guess, to think of it, putting ourselves into it, but at the same time, not caring, but.
There isn't any overall picture. There's no overall way of doing it. You just have to do it as you do it. You just come from there. Come from that. Or carry, not even carry. There's no place to go with it. It's only a matter, really, of noticing what's going on, and as Uchiyama Roshi said, you open the hand of thought if you find it closed. You know, and we do that. We close up and we hold on, and then we notice, and then we open it up. Oh, of course. And that's loving kindness. All by itself is just to let it go. So it depends. Every single situation is lived as we live it. There isn't any formula, really. It's just how it comes through us as we are. Ching?
Yesterday, I went to a Doctors Without Borders made up camp. A mock camp, a refugee camp. in San Francisco. And they had, a dozen led tour. And they also had pictures of the camp. And absolutely spoiled condition that people were living in. And they lived there for a couple of decades. And there's nothing. They were living in the cars.
Yeah.
They had nothing.
Yeah.
They're completely dependent on the international aid organizations to bring in everything.
And it's not just in one place either.
It's
in so many places.
Square miles.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, you look around and you're surrounded by nothing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's like, objectively, you are pinned in this.
Mm-hmm.
What can you make of that?
I don't think we can make of it. I mean, we can experience it as deeply as we allow ourselves to. And from that experience, we can do what we do. And for some of us, like Beth, we actually go there. For some of us, like you, we work for an agency that supports Doctors Without Borders. For some of us, we cultivate a life in a world that serves in some way. But not any one of us can help eradicate that whole, I don't know what to call it, that enormity of suffering without a change of mind. A cultural change of mind, you could say. And it's beyond any one of us. I often think of can't think of his first name, Fielding, the novelist who wrote Tom Jones. He was also an attorney in 17th century England during a time of immense poverty. When the way they dealt with the poor was to make gin free, so that they handed out gin and got everybody drunk every single day so that they didn't complain and they didn't rise up. And Fielding just about single-handedly cleaned it up. There was corruption everywhere. The whole government was totally corrupt. And somehow he was so persuasive that he managed to, in his lifetime, it took him his whole life, to clean the city of London up and to begin to change England. And I think of him so often because, we're all waiting for another Fielding to come along and help us do it again. Because we're all pecking away at it. I think anyone who has any ounce of compassion is just wounded by the wounds of the world. And yet, we have so little power to do anything about it, except to suffer it with everyone. And we suffer it in extremely comfortable surroundings. So, I don't know. When somebody in Sesshin once years ago said to Coben while we were sitting, she said, "I'm just so sad. Everything is so sad." And he said, "We'll just all cry together." And I think sometimes we just have to all cry together. And if we find something that we can do, we can all work together on it too. It's part of the weirdness of our situation, I think.
You know, the work I do, I'm leaving and going back, and now I'm like, trying to work part-time, which is horrible, but at the same time, I keep leaving it, as opposed to, like, really, I represent foster kids right now, so everyone's been abused and neglected, everyone's been traumatized, and it's like, it's all the time, like, it's everything that I do, it's everything I read, everything I do, and I think that if we just keep that, I mean, it's not the whole thing. It's because also these kids, if that's all we see in them, then when we're, it's like, it's only seeing one thing, you know? And I think I was just thinking about, you were talking about these conditions, and when I visit my relatives in India, they have this idea about how we live, and it's how it's all perfect, and we've got paved roads, and everything's just fine, you know, and then we're like, oh my gosh, you must be so horrible over there, but they're fine, you know, and I think we only know our experience, but everything else is so foreign, and I think it can get a little journalistic too, that this is the standard, and then everyone else, it must be horrible, you know, but it's all the same. It's the different parts of the thing. And it doesn't mean we don't help, obviously. I do, and I think that to try to bring it all together, maybe that's the problem, that it's so separate, and that this is more important than this, and that's why there's so much suffering. But that's how I feel. I think that, you know, that it's part of the whole thing, and it doesn't mean to not acknowledge it. I mean, I was talking to Angie about how we don't know, like, we put it on us, oh, it must be so horrible to live in certain conditions, but we don't know how people are living in it, are living, right? Maybe it's okay. But, you know, it's like, it's nothing maybe okay. It's just who you are, you are.
Touching on it, they had a picture of a malnourished baby. It was just awful. And they fed the baby the pumpy nut product that saved children's lives. And then they had the after picture where the plump, happy baby is with her mom, and her mom is smiling. And, you know, I was wondering, how is it for her? You know, she's happy about her child. And yeah, I'm weighing all these things that you're saying. Of course she's happy her child survived. But, you know, what about... So, it is fine. You know, we do not only survive, but flower wherever we are. And that's what I'm trying to understand. Mm-hmm. How can somebody flower in a situation like that? I know it's not going to be day after day tortured. No one could sustain that. We would die. So I guess that's what I'm trying to understand. It's just a feeling for is how can that person, what is it about life that somebody, what is the life there that this woman can be happy?
Yeah.
it helps me to know some of the people that we're talking about. So your kids, I'll read this whole time, like this beautiful woman, so she's 18 and you're in foster care, you're basically dependent on the court until you're 18 and they throw you out on the street, and all these stories about how most of the kids are just a mess. You know, they've been through, they're just a mess, you know. But this, I did one court appearance for her, which is the dismissal of the case, but I've been working like 2 weeks, it's great. But this beautiful, in college, you know, 18, living on her own, paying rent, just whole, you know, just wonderful. And then you read the file, or every other attorneys are all like, oh, she was sexually abused by her brother for 9 years, now he's in prison, she was this, you know, all this stuff that she had been through. But there's also this beautiful woman who has her whole life ahead of her. And, you know, something about, and the same thing in LA too, like, I would not want to know what the guys did or what they've been through. I just want to connect with you. And that helps me a lot. Otherwise, I'd just be sad about everything. And it's not always. I mean, I'm horrible things happen too.
Donnelly.
I feel like a commercial. Mm-hmm.
Conversely, there's very, you know, what can make somebody happy, what can make somebody so miserable that's living in a mansion and has everything at their disposal. I think for me, I have to watch my own judgment and my own projection and transference of my values to that thing. I think that's also what we're saying. Not, I mean, more close to home, too, is how does, and I think you've probably heard me say that, but how can one person sober up and stay sober, clean and sober all their life, and another person can't? I mean, that's something like right next door to us, or in this room. So there's so much the suffering. I mean, I'm not going to say they're not. I mean, there's tremendous suffering. I mean, in this camp, and I can't. I've been to a lot of places. I haven't been to refugee camps. I'm thinking of people living in jails. We lock people up for 18 years in solitary confinement, you know, here and there. I mean, it's just there's so many different suffering that we can add to ourselves. So it's Angie told me years ago in Dokasami, and I thought I was just going to like go, yeah, thanks a lot. And she said to me, what did I say? And I was complaining, or actually I was sharing, complaining, whining about all the suffering that was going on in my life. And she sat there very stoic and said that it's nothing personal. And I know you've heard me say this before, but that was a poem for some time. Really catching on that, for me, what I've learned from that, and it comes back to the mustard seed, everyone is touched by death and ugliness and suffering. And it's not personal. Everyone is. It's not. There it is, at some level. Now, I'm not, you know, again, it gets into, well, this is worse and this is not. And I really can't know that. They wanted to do that, actually, in grief groups. Somebody, you know, how are you going to decide if somebody dies of a suicide is worse than somebody dies of a heart attack or someone who dies after 10 months of suffering can't, you know, death and suffering is. And the story of the mustard seed is, well, I'll paraphrase it because I'm not going to remember all of it, but there was a gal that lost her baby. And I'm sure you probably all heard this a long time ago. And she was just bereft with grief. I mean, she was literally going nuts. And she carried this dead baby in her arm for weeks and however long, and going around trying to find someone to save her baby that died. And they said, oh, there's a really wise man in the next village over. Go over there and he'll help you. So got to the other village, asked for the wise man, and it was Buddha. And Buddha said, okay, I'll help you, you know, with your baby, you know, if you can find me a mustard seed from somebody in a home
that has no experience yet. And that poor woman, again, she went all over again looking for a mustard seed. Everybody, at some point in their home, had experienced death. And then, of course, when she realized that, she laid the baby to rest. But again, I have to watch myself around. You know, and I'm not saying, I mean, I can't even imagine all the atrocities that are going on in South Africa, all these other places in the world that's not on the news, and not even, I don't even know where they are in the world. I'm so ignorant of what's going on. I can't say that, I'm not saying that that's not suffering. It's just a whole lot of it going on. And what do you make of it? And I know that it's nothing personal. Like, I don't know, I always go back to the first Bodhisattva vow. It's not about saving all beings, but there's probably only one being that I can attempt to make some type of effort with. Even that is tricky. Anyway, it's a really, really interesting topic.
Yeah. It kind of makes me just think of prayer. I remember last talking, we spoke about that, and it's also, there's a very humbling aspect to like trying to approach your like your actions, like realizing how possibly such a little dent it can make any kind of suffering, but there's still this push to try and alleviate as much suffering as we can. In that process, there's kind of a letting go involved. It's kind of freeing.
May all beings be happy. May they be joyous and live in safety. And all beings is us. That's the mystery. That's the basic mystery. You know, it feels like this little wee thing right here is the whole thing, or the only thing. But it doesn't work like that. So the Bodhisattva vow is to just keep coming back as long as there's anybody else. We don't practice to get out of this, we practice to stay in and to be with everyone, whatever the situation. And to wish all well.
It's good to ignore, like, the whole wishing them all well, like, the people who have, like, made possible for us in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's kind of, there's a danger to not think that just look over those exceptions that we make.
Yeah, I wish everybody well except that person over there who's a real pain in the neck. Thich Nhat Hanh talks about that often, about how it's very easy to wish, to feel all warm and cozy about loving everybody until, you know, the police start beating up people in the ghetto or something like that, and then you start hating the police for doing that. And then he said it takes a lot of work to wrap your mind around the truth of the life of each person, including the policeman, who is suffering also. So those who create suffering are also suffering. So again, it's including, you know, what we tend not to include.
Husband or the wife.
Yes, yes. It's all their fault. But actually, we're all in it together, so it's all of our doing.
I wrote that beautiful poem, Call Me By Your True Name.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I believe it communicates that very.
Yeah.
I'll send it. It's, are you familiar with any of those poems? I'll send it to you.
Yeah, I imagine being every bad person as well as the good people. It's hard to do. It's hard to accept. But the more we know ourselves, the more we know what's in us. And everything is in us. Every possibility. Some more.